It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, we launch our brand new summer music series, Set List. We'll hear interviews and exclusive musical performances from Wisconsin artists. Today, we'll hear from Madison wife and husband duo, Count This Penny. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Some progress on the state budget, Governor Walker filing papers to run for president. We'll cover these stories and more right now. We've got J.R. Ross with us. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome to the show.
How are you doing this afternoon?
Well, good. So there's been gridlock over the budget for some weeks now. The JFC, Joint Finance Committee, able to agree on a plan and pass it. What had to happen? What changes had to happen to get that rolling?
It's important to understand that this is not really a budget agreement. This is an agreement to get it past joint finance and move it on to the full legislature. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is they've been hung up on whether to make changes to prevailing wage in the budget, whether to include public financing for a Bucks arena in Milwaukee in the budget, and how to do transportation funding. They basically reached an agreement on one of those things, and that was transportation. They figured out a way that they would lower the bonding. Governor Walker wanted to borrow $1.3 billion for roads the next 2 years. They lowered that to $500 million, but also kept another $350 million in reserve they could let out, if you will. So that's the agreement that gets the budget moving, but they also took the prevailing wage pieces away and the Bucks piece away and said, okay, we'll deal with those separately and try to go from there. So this basically allowed it to clear the Joint Finance Committee and move now to the full legislature the next week.
But that, as you say, doesn't mean that what they've ended up passing on joint finance is necessarily going to pass both houses of the legislature.
No, it was interesting, actually. The prevailing wage, they announced this deal on Wednesday, that how they're going to handle the prevailing wage bill. And then last night, at least one member of the Finance Committee tried to force a vote on putting prevailing wage in to the budget at that point in the process. That caused a two-hour delay as they talked about whether to do that. And ultimately, they decided not to take it up and have that debate publicly. But there is definitely some consternation among Republicans about changes to the prevailing wage law that they want to have made in Wisconsin.
So there were other late changes here in the budget yesterday. We're going to talk about changes to the open records laws coming up after 4:30. But what else struck you that made it into what joint finance ended up passing?
Well, to be honest, the prevailing wage, the open records provisions, that's really what's gotten the most attention because it overshadowed a lot of the other things that were done. I mean, they made all kinds of changes. Last night was the last day of finance met, and I've covered now, I think, seven or eight budgets and budget repair bills. The last motion by finance is always this kind of grab all, if you will, of all kinds of things. They tweaked, for example, they wanted to change the teacher licensure in Wisconsin so that if you were somebody who, for example, were a cabinet maker and you could go in and teach woodworking at a high school, even if you don't have a degree. They took that part out of the budget, realized that was not what they wanted to do. They tweaked things for kids who are homeschooled, for example, allow them to play high school sports, the district they live in. So in all these changes, the budget in this wrap-up motion, but really the stuff that got attention was open records because it is something that, one, makes sweeping changes to the open records law, but two, it was introduced at about 5 o'clock yesterday and thrown out there with no real discussion beforehand. Democrats got a couple hours to look over this or an hour to look over it and figure out what was in there. They came back and went. So it's not the usual process you see for a bill where it's introduced, has a public hearing, there's a discussion, then a committee vote. Now, they kind of push it through, if you will, very quickly and trying to ram this through into the budget.
And it's not clear who put that in, as I understand it.
Nobody wants to own up to it so far, which kind of shows you that it's not something that they know it's not very popular politically, but it's something that they personally want to see done.
Talking to J.R. Ross from WisPolitics and a review of what's in Wisconsin news this week. So do we have a timeline? We're past a deadline, J.R., already. Do we have a timeline on when a budget might be done?
Well, you know, the thing about Wisconsin is we don't shut down if the budget's not done when the fiscal year starts. That happened July 1st, which was Tuesday. I think if I've got my days right, Wednesday, whatever
Wednesday,
it was.
Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Wednesday. It was a late night last night.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So anyway, but when the new fiscal year starts and the biennium starts, nothing changes. All that happens is we keep spending money the same clip we were in the previous budgets. There's no real deadline or pressure, if you will, to get something done other than they want to get it done and get out of town. You know, they want to go have their summer and go back home and all that kind of jazz. Plus, you know, Governor Walker's announcing for president in about a week and a half, so they want that out of the way, all that kind of stuff. But there's no deadline to get it done. That said, They're going to try and move it next week. The Assembly's going to come in for sure on Wednesday and take up, we believe, a prevailing wage bill and a budget bill. Now, the Senate was supposed to go second on the budget, but then Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald told us last night that they actually may go first and take it up on maybe even Tuesday. So it's kind of up in the air how this is going to go. Basically, the issue really is in the Senate. Scott Fitzgerald has 19 members in his caucus and a 33-member chamber, so he can lose two members and still pass a budget. The problem is he's got at least three who are saying they want to have significant prevailing wage changes in the budget or they won't vote for it. They've got a couple other members who are quietly not happy about putting prevailing wage in the budget. Rob Cole, a Republican from the Green Bay area today, said he won't vote for the budget if it has the open records changes in it. So he has all these competing interests, if you will. He's got to try and balance to get to 17. It's not a very clear path right now how he's going to do that.
Now, I want to spend a few moments on Governor Walker. You mentioned he's filed his papers, announcing on the 13th, hoping to have that budget done before then. What do we know about his plans to announce this candidacy? How is he going to unveil his official run?
Well, I've got a source that told me that the announcement is going to be at the Waukesha County Expo Center. There's some significance in that for Governor Walker. If you recall, in 2012, when there was the attempt to recall him, he beat it back. He was at the Waukesha County Expo Center, kind of on his election night party, if you will. So that really launched him in the national discussion about politically. He's kind of going back to that launching pad to again launch, this time for president. So, and, you know, we've already seen the message. Let's be honest. Governor Walker's running for president for some time now, all right? This is just a formality, if you will, a different filing with the FEC. He can raise money by different amounts. He's not going to travel less or, you know, talk to fewer people nationally or more. He's going to do what he's been doing for weeks and weeks and weeks because he is, for all intents and purposes, in this race. And I'll tell you, I try not to be surprised in politics. I can tell you the only thing that would surprise me is if Governor Walker said no. That would be the biggest shock in my 15 years covering the Capitol if he said no, I'm not going to run.
JR, thanks a lot for catching us up.
Anytime. Have a great day.
You too. That's J.R. Ross, editor for WisPolitics.com, helping us review the biggest headlines from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee made sweeping changes to the state's public records law. We'll talk with our reporter on the scene and a political observer. First, today on Central Time, we launch a new summer music series called Setlist. We invite Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. We'll air them every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend, the unofficial end of summer. From Americana to hip-hop, we're going to hear a diverse range of original music made by Wisconsin artists. We kick off Setlist with a wife and husband group who, until very recently, called Madison their home. Born in the foothills of the Great Smoky Mountains, Count This Penny are the singer-songwriter duo of Amanda and Alan Rigel. In 2010, they made their way to Madison and have toured the country and released several albums. They recently sat down with Veronica Rickert in the WPR studios to play some new unreleased songs, tell us about playing in a band with your spouse, and let us in on what it's like to jam with Garrison Keillor on a Prairie Home Companion.
All right, Amanda and Alan, thank you so much for playing in the studio today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Of course.
This is really fun.
Well, let's start with sort of your band origin story. How did you guys first start doing music together?
Well, we found ourselves watching a lot of cable television under the guise of doing other things like, oh, I'm grading these papers, or oh, I'm studying for this test, and we're like, oh, I'm doing sit-ups. But none of those things were happening?
Sit-ups?
I don't know.
I
told myself many lies about why it was okay to watch so much television.
Oh, sure. Right.
And then we thought, we can't do this anymore. We're going crazy. We're like actively losing intelligence. And so we canceled our cable, and then we thought, what will we do now? And we started playing music together. It's like the least romantic origin story of all time. We canceled our cable and we needed something to do.
We were just bored. What's that wooden thing on the shelf over
just
there?
Just an all-American band.
So the moral of the story, if you cancel your cable, you'll become a band.
Yeah.
I do believe so. Amazing things can happen if you cancel your cable.
Well, I guess you undo me when you pull.
Now, were you two husband and wife at that point, or were you just, I don't know, friends? Or
I think we were husband and wife at that point.
So Amanda and I have known each other for a long time. We grew up in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and met each other in band, playing
high school band,
yes, playing trumpet together. And I remember watching Amanda sing in an open mic or something along those lines, even back then. So I knew that she was pretty musically talented even going back then. So it wasn't as if we just all of a sudden decided to learn what a G chord was. But I think when we did cancel the cable, that's when we started singing together, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
Outside of, like, singing Ben Harper tunes around a campfire or something.
Yeah, that's interesting, because most husbands and wives who perform together, they come together around music, and that's sort of the thing that brings them together. But you guys were already together, and then music sort of was your plus one later on.
It's true. Music is our plus one. I like that.
Not our dog.
Oh, our dog is our first plus one.
Yeah.
Music is our plus two.
That's our plus two. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true. Wow, you're such a loyalist.
Well,
she's a great dog, though.
She's probably listening.
I think she might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We were already together, and this became sort of like a fun, great thing to do together.
When you pound it, just leave the rest for me. And when you skin your knees, I will drag it to your feet. Cause I believe in your heart, and I can fall asleep.
So you said you're from Tennessee, and I've read that that really influences your music a lot, about what comes out in it. How would you say that that Southern musical structure that you had growing up, I guess, influences what you do now?
It's probably, honestly, like 50% influence in the Southeast, just growing up with family members and friends who played music, and also 50% like marketing. You know, we're from the Southeast, and it's nice to come to the Midwest and say that we have these sort of Appalachian roots.
That's true.
You know, I think maybe Midwesterners are naturally drawn to that, and we're happy to take advantage of it.
Yeah, we came up with the catchphrase Appalachian Pop.
Which doesn't mean anything.
We made it up, and then one of my cousins was like, you can't say that down here. Just only use that in the Midwest.
Cracked ribs from a punch you took a week ago. No, we can't outrun the shadows that we can.
So how does the Madison music scene compare to Appalachia or Tennessee?
Well, the Madison music scene is great, and it's really multifaceted. I think the outlets we were accustomed to listening to, like the radio station we really loved in Knoxville, is definitely Americana folk-oriented, and there's a really strong scene in that way. But there's a great sort of punk underground scene there, or there has been historically. Mm-hmm. And I think Madison is very much the same way, and it's kind of how do you plug in. But in both places, I think there's just tons of collaboration and tons of musical friendships and communities that are built on that, which is really, really exciting. It's super cool.
I think we can speak a little bit more honestly to the Madison music scene because we haven't been doing this that long. So we started playing together and playing in front of people outside of playing in front of our dog, maybe like 6 months before we moved to Madison.
Yeah.
So when we got here, we got to meet all these great musicians and got to learn from them. And so I have a much better understanding of what the Madison music scene is relative to the Knoxville or the Johnson City music scene.
Yeah, we really cut our teeth here.
Yeah, we cut our teeth. And our sad folk teeth.
We have no teeth.
Yeah, no teeth. Yeah.
For better past. Only fools fight for better past.
Is it easier, do you think, to play here? Because you don't think... I mean, I think if I were a musician starting up in Knoxville, I would think, wow, there's such history here, such tradition, and just to poke my head up and dare to play might take an act of courage. Whereas in Madison, it's not necessarily a music mecca. Maybe it would feel more okay to just start out here and see what you got.
It may be in theory. I remember we played with this banjo player by the name of John Ray, who moved back to Texas a couple years ago. And when we took John on the road back to the South, he got really nervous. He was thinking that all these great, amazing banjo players were going to show up and judge him. Even in playing in Nashville, you know, he would get sort of amped up before these sad folk shows. And it's not the case. Obviously, there are great musicians down there, but there are fantastic musicians in Madison as well. And I think it was just about sort of having the courage to stand up and play in front of people, because that was sort of the hardest hurdle, I think.
But it was easier to start playing in Madison than
well,
because we were strangers.
Yeah,
I mean, we didn't know anyone, so it was like, well, what do you have to lose? Whereas in Tennessee, it's like, there's my grandmother and your grandmother and your sister and my brother and my sister-in-law and my dad and our little niece and nephew, you know, and like, oh my gosh, we swear in this song. And
it definitely feels more like a recital.
It's more, it's somehow more nerve-wracking to have all those people who unconditionally love you somehow is much more nerve-wracking than a room full of, you know, Mickeys where everybody's just like, who are these jokers?
Right.
You know,
the expectations are pretty low.
That part was really fun because we sort of intentionally said, when we move up there, let's just be a band and we'll just tell people we have a band. And it was really great. People here are so nice. They believed us. Mm-hmm. You know, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a hangman curve coming down the road. I can feel you pulling from home. And I won't break my back to hold you back and love you less when I'm alone. Kept your daddy's flesh clean and tucked away. Another winter candle sundown in your veins. You're running out the family line with every bar you claim. The horses come and pace against the reins. Yeah, the horses come and pace against the reins.
Well, swinging around to the topics that you cover in your songs, I mean, these are not exactly upbeat, feel-good songs. They're songs about relationships falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
What draws you to that kind of material? I've also read that you like to write about murders and suicides and things like that. So what is
Where
it about
Where are you getting
that?
This material?
Yeah. How do you know about that? The murder ballad really was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek. But I think the combination of coming here and telling people we're Appalachian and I have this murder ballad, they're like, this is legit. She definitely killed someone in the woods.
You wrote that song because it was like negative 10 to below and you needed to get outside and you were angry at the world.
Yeah,
right?
We had just moved here and it snowed 18 inches and I wrote a murder ballad while Alan was away.
And well, that explains everything.
Yeah. And that was a fun night around the dinner table.
Yeah, the horses come and bear.
Well, I heard you guys pretty recently got a gig singing on a Prairie Home Companion. What was that like, and how did you land that?
I'm not sure. I honestly wonder if someone at WPR put in a good word for us, because, I mean, we were so floored to be offered that I asked the talent buyer, or whatever he's called, and I said, how did you hear about us? And he's like, oh, well, we have our channels, and your name came up, so... And that's all he would say. He's like a very no-nonsense kind of guy.
We felt like we were playing way above our pay grade.
Yeah, oh, still do. Yeah, for
sure. I remember looking at the computer worrying about if we were going to get offered this opening slot at a local venue like on a Wednesday night or something. And Amanda and I were super excited about the possibility of maybe getting this show because maybe there would be like 50 or 75 people.
Oh, maybe
something.
There would be like 20 people.
Yeah, maybe there'd be like 20 people. Yeah. You know, we're just like, oh man, this is such a cool opportunity. And then out of the blue, this email legitimately comes out of right field. And
I thought it was like a joke that someone was playing on us.
Yeah, we definitely had to call around to make sure it wasn't a joke.
Yeah.
And we were still very green, and I bet you can imagine we were incredibly nervous. And, you know, I think we probably played the three songs that we played on that show, you know, 17 times in the green room while while we're warming up, you know, like all that nervous energy. So we're definitely playing above our pay grade, but it was a fantastic experience. It was really cool.
We did a lot of positive self-talk the week before. It was
Don't blow it.
No, it was really more like you're the best. You're the best. You can do it. You guys are great. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And did Garrison do the thing where he comes out and sings with you?
Yes. That was the most nerve-wracking. And actually, a friend of ours warned us that would happen. He said, don't freak out, but Garrison Keillor is definitely going to ask you guys to sing harmony on something that you don't know that well. And we were like, no way. That'll never happen to us. And then it did.
What song did we sing?
We sang Keep on the Sunny Side.
Keep on the Sunny Side.
And I will always remember that song for the rest of my life as not the most shining moment.
I know. So we started singing in rehearsal, and he said, I'm going to take the high harmony. And then he looked at me and said, you're going to take the low harmony. And remember, I said we were pretty green at that point in time. And then he was like, I can't hear the guy. Sing a little bit louder.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I don't know what you're talking about.
And then
you know,
he would
I just try to sing the melody.
Like, I think you're stepping on my note.
So, yeah, it was an adventure.
It's all a blur because we were just trembling with nervousness for that whole experience.
No, I can't tell memories from dreams.
Sounds a good place to leave it, guys. Thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
No, you can't tell me from a dove. Loving arms of the Lord. Just look at the places I've been. Shake hands with the man I fell in love with. No, you can't tell me from a dove.
That was singer-songwriter duo Count This Penny talking to Veronica Rickert. You can catch them playing around Wisconsin in August and September. Go to countthispenny.com for a list of tour dates. Setlist Music Series airs on Central Time Fridays at 4:15 from today through early September. For more about Count This Penny and other featured artists, including songs and videos of their full exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist. Next Friday, we on Setlist will feature Arrow Flynn, a rock band with Eau Claire roots that brought together friends to help complete their long-awaited and critically acclaimed debut album. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up this Sunday marks 5 years since Wisconsin's indoor smoking ban went into effect. We'll take a look at what's changed since then. First, under a surprise budget amendment passed last night by Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee, records created by state and local government officials could become exempt from open records law. This means that a wide range of legislative business, from drafting bills to legislative proceedings and investigations, would no longer be subject to public scrutiny. The changes were introduced as part of a final budget motion on the JFC. WPR reporter Sean Johnson joins us from the Capitol for an update. Sean, thanks for being back with us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So a late night session yesterday. I know you were up late covering this. What would this amendment do? What would this change do to the way open records laws work in the state?
It is pretty sweeping. I mean, it makes changes in quite a few ways to open records in Wisconsin. One is it would exclude this new category of deliberative materials from Wisconsin's open records law. So that means anything from opinions, analyses, briefings, background information, recommendations, suggestions, drafts, correspondence about drafts, and notes developed by lawmakers. Those would all be excluded from the open records law. It would give legislators the power to prohibit legislative staff and former legislative staff from publicly disclosing any communications or records made in a legislator's office. So essentially a gag order on legislative staff and former staff. Bill drafting files would no longer be made public. So that'd make it harder to find out why bills get written the way they do, and in some cases, who wrote the bills. I mean, these are the kinds of files that were used earlier this year to confirm that Governor Walker's administration made some deliberate changes to the Wisconsin idea and the UW mission statement. And then it would spell out, the budget motion last night would spell out that rules and policies of the legislature would trump the open records law. So if the Senate passes a rule that that says we're going to treat these records differently, there's nothing in state law that could trump that.
So a lot of reaction since this came out. Can you talk about who's saying what about this change?
Instantaneously. I mean, this is a rare issue in Wisconsin that seems to have united conservatives and liberals. I mean, you've got reporters and, you know, editorial boards came out pretty vigorously against this from the get-go, which I think is to be expected. But you got to remember there are liberal groups and conservative groups that rely on open records to do what they do. And so you saw organizations like the Conservative MacIver Institute, the liberal group One Wisconsin Now, on the same page on this, saying it's a terrible idea that it should be taken out of the budget, demanding to know who put it in the budget. And that's a question we still don't know the answer to.
Yeah, let's talk about that. It seems like reporters from pretty much everywhere that has reporters have been trying to figure out who put this in, who is supporting this. Any luck?
This was added to the budget in this wrap-up motion that it's just a catch-all motion that they vote on at the end of every budget cycle.
This is the 999 motion people are talking about?
They didn't always call it that, but they have recently. The 999 motion where just you know, a whole range of topics get put in there. I mean, for example, last night we're talking about the open records changes because they're huge, but this also made changes to collective bargaining laws, to the definition of lead-bearing paint, it allowed for a 7-day work week, changes to minimum wage requirements, payday lender authority. This is a catch-all motion that stuff gets added to, and typically everybody in the majority party votes for it. In this case, all 12 Republicans on the legislature's Joint Finance Committee voted for these changes that would restrict open records in Wisconsin, but none of them will come out and say wholeheartedly, yes, that was mine.
So Governor Walker has joined the response. Evidently, we've been hearing the news today saying he is expecting to work with lawmakers on this issue. Do we know if this is likely to come back out based on the response?
I don't know if it's going to come back out. Here's what the governor's spokesperson said. Quote, prior to the budget going to the full legislature for action, Governor Walker plans to work with legislative leaders to make changes to the provisions included in the current proposal related to the state's open records law. We don't know what those changes are. We don't know what that means. That is not a statement saying this is no good, I'm going to veto this. Changes could mean anything. I mean, this makes so many changes to the open records law that a tweak here and there, you might not even notice it. So that will all become clearer next week because the Assembly and the State Senate want to move on the budget pretty quickly.
All right, Sean, I've got a hunch we'll be talking to you about this again. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That was WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson talking about this change to open records laws here in Wisconsin, approved by the Joint Finance Committee. Still steps to go on that. Well, Sean mentioned the McIver Institute. Well, with us now is Brett Healy. He's president of the John K. McIver Institute for Public Policy, a Wisconsin-based think tank. Brett, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
So your organization called this a dark day for Wisconsin government. Why is this a bad idea in your eyes?
Well, Wisconsin has a long and proud tradition of open government, and clearly the language that was inserted last night in the 999 motion is a step backwards. As Sean pointed out, this would be a sweeping change that essentially protects just about every document the legislature or any elected official in Wisconsin would ever work on, and shield it from the public, who would no longer have a right to request that information under the state's open records law.
So what does the public lose there if it doesn't have that access, if the press, if groups like yours don't have access to this material?
Well, so much of what goes on, especially when it comes to policymaking, is done outside of the view of the public. Private conversations between lawmakers, leadership talking to their members, and oftentimes outside groups can only turn to the paper trail to try and figure out what the policy is a group is pursuing, and more importantly, why they're trying to make changes to state laws. So it is a key tool, the open records law, for the public to keep tabs on their lawmakers and have an idea of what exactly is going into the public policy process at the state capitol.
Well, we've heard Representative Dean Knutson has had some favorable comments in the press. He's an Assembly Republican. He's a member of Joint Finance. We invited him to appear. He wasn't available today. But here's him talking on the committee about this issue.
The legislative process involves talking with people and communicating with people. And at times, you want to be able to do that without creating a formal, open, public record. And that's the balancing test here.
So to hash out things in the legislature, he's saying sometimes you need that starting process anyway to not feel like you have somebody looking over your shoulders. You hash out the basics, and then eventually you're going to have a publicly released bill. So is there some case to be made for a little bit of leeway for some private talks on legislation, Brett?
Well, but this proposal goes way beyond that and shields just about any and all communication, drafts, any sort of analysis, commentary from the public. I would argue that you can have casual conversations right now under the current system about legislative ideas, bounce ideas off people. But what you can't shield from the public is when you start to put these ideas down on paper, send them to legislative attorneys for their opinion or their thoughts on how something should be drafted. That process gives the public insight into what exactly is going on at the Capitol, and it's that sort of deliberation, those sort of discussions, that work that we need to maintain in the public view.
Here's another voice from the Joint Finance Committee, Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach, talking about this issue.
It doesn't get and will not get any worse than this. I don't care what the issue is. I don't care what's coming up in the future. This, by far and away, will be the vote. When you're 90 years old, you'll be going, damn, I wish I had that one back. I wish I had that one back. And every single headline we're going to see moving forward that involves corruption here in the state of Wisconsin, that involves kickbacks, is on your head because you're voting to let this happen.
Now, Brett, we play this in part because your organization, the McIver Institute, has previously been in court over trying to get records from Senator Erpenbach's office. Right now, you're on the same side. He talked about you favorably. You're on with him. This doesn't happen often.
Politics sometimes makes for strange bedfellows, as we told Mr. Senator Erpenbach over Twitter last night. Yeah, you're exactly right. We had a lawsuit against Senator Erpenbach. We asked for some records, constituent records, who contacted him about Act 10, very controversial subject. At first, he chose to redact the names, addresses, and phone numbers of the people who contacted him. There is a longstanding Supreme Court case that has decided long ago that petitioning your government is subject to the open records law. And so eventually the court system in Wisconsin ruled in our favor, and we were able to get those documents unredacted. And but here again, this goes to show just how serious the situation is. Enemies in the court system, and philosophically we're opposites. But Senator Erpenbach and I agree that this is a bad, bad idea and a step backwards for open government.
We're talking to Brett Healy with the McIver Institute, looking at changes to Wisconsin's open records law introduced by the state's Joint Finance Committee and approved by that committee last night. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this change? Do you think open records are important? Are you worried about what this does to access to what lawmakers do? Or do you think they deserve, need a lot of leeway to draft documents without them ever going into the public eye? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about changes to Wisconsin's public records law introduced by Republican lawmakers on Joint Finance last night, part of the big final budget amendment before they send it to both houses of the legislature. It takes a lot of things currently accessible in open records requests, makes them inaccessible. Want to hear your thoughts on this. Are you worried about this change? Why are open records laws important? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We have Brett Healy with us, president of the McIver Institute for Public Policy. And straight to your calls, we've got Steve on the line in Eau Claire. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you think of this?
Well, I think it's probably even worse than the attempt to remove and change the Wisconsin idea for the University of Wisconsin. It's ironic that this happened. It attempts to shield anyone who discusses the laws. It's proposed on the Thursday afternoon before a Friday holiday, and we can't find out who made the proposal. This is exactly what's going to happen when we get to the point of this law being implemented. I don't really understand where anyone's coming from on this.
Steve, thanks for the call. Steve agrees with you, Brett, on the content of the law. What do you think about the timing of it and the way it was introduced?
Oh, you know, anytime you unveil a sweeping idea like this, and no matter the subject, this late in the process, and as the caller pointed out, you know, 5:30 on the Thursday before a holiday weekend, it is going to raise all sorts of questions. You know, it surely raised the ire of the media in the room. So I'm not sure what leadership was trying to accomplish by adding this language this late in the process, but I think they underestimated the fierce and reaction from the public and from open government advocates all across the state.
Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Frank in La Crosse. Frank, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is just that this motion, this proposal, in a sense, amounts to secret government. There seems to be a movement among some politicians that the only participation that citizens should have in government is to elect representatives, and then, as Chris Christie says, they should sit down and shut up and apparently not listen either. That's my comment.
Frank, thanks for the call. Frank saying citizens should be more involved, not less, I guess, in the way our laws are made. Do you see citizens playing enough of a role, Brett, as it is under the current open records laws?
Frank's right. We need people to participate. It's easier to participate if we can keep the citizens informed on what's going on. The open records law is a key component of that effort, and it's bipartisan in nature. It's actually a nonpartisan effort to open and transparent government. As you mentioned earlier, there are groups on all sides of the political spectrum who have come out opposed to this provision. And I think you're going to see, you know, every major news outlet in the state editorialize against it as well. So I think the groundswell is building, and I think the grassroots voices will be heard, especially early next week when people get back from the 4th and realize what exactly was passed.
One more caller, Tim in Kenosha now. Tim, hi.
Hello. Yes, interesting topic. The huge word in capital letters is trust, and that it's already low, and this seems like this would bring trust in the legislature down in the negative figures. What I worry about at this point is everybody says, oh, this is terrible, let's fix it. But then let's look at the details about how it's going to be fixed and what items are going to remain. That's my worry.
Tim, thanks. Trust in government, as Tim says, Brett, already not great. Do you see this undermining confidence further?
Oh, clearly this doesn't help, and Tim's also right about the process. The legislature is hoping to be done with the budget here this next week, and so the idea that perhaps you could pull together stakeholders here in the next few days and come to some sort of agreement on the language that inserted is, I just don't know if we have time for that, and quite frankly, I don't think this is the appropriate vehicle for a change like this. So I hope that the language would come out, and if lawmakers are serious that they think there needs to be changes to the open records law, they would sit down with groups like the Freedom of Information Council and the newspapers across the state and see if we can find some common ground if changes are needed. But to try and do this at this late stage of the budget process, it just doesn't make sense.
Brett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Brett Healy, president of the John K. McIver Institute for Public Policy, a Wisconsin-based think tank that promotes free markets, individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited government, talking about proposed changes to Wisconsin's open records laws. Thousands of people are expected to enjoy Wisconsin State Parks this holiday weekend. Maybe you're already at a park or on the way as you're listening. This could be the last summer during which general state tax dollars help support those parks. Unless the legislature or Governor Walker change a budget proposal soon, the park system will have to lean more on user fees, grants, and volunteers. Chuck Kornbach filed this report.
State parks already count a lot on volunteers. On a recent Saturday morning at Devil's Lake State Park near Baraboo, about 10 members of that park's friends group, under the direction of a park employee, walked carefully through the woods, pulling up invasive garlic mustard plants and putting them in a plastic bag.
That's the garlic mustard there.
Joan Call has volunteered at Devil's Lake for many years. She says it's a wonderful park, at times crowded. It draws 1.5 million visitors a year. But Call says it's also a serene place, deserving upkeep.
It's a beautiful area, but if they don't take care of it, case in point, the garlic mustard, it'll just take over this area and you won't have the beautiful flowers and stuff.
But Governor Walker and Republicans controlling the legislature's budget committee appear to be headed for a major change in how Wisconsin funds the state parks. Current budget language would make Wisconsin just one of a handful of states to do away with any general tax revenues for the parks. User fees are going up, and there could be other major financial changes down the road a couple years, maybe even a sale of naming rights. Republican Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst hasn't granted our recent requests for an interview, but during Joint Finance Committee deliberations in May, Tiffany summed up the new philosophy.
Moving to more of a user-based system, I think, is very appropriate. The people that utilize a service, they should pay for that service.
But the president of Friends of Devil's Lake, Todd Pershey, says relying more on user fees at a time when some parks have had to defer maintenance may be risky.
You know, for $3 or $4 million, I would rather be certain that we know we're going to be able to fund this going forward, and to take a chance on this, especially now when there's so many things going on. You know, we have a lot of issues that we have to deal with out here, and it just seems like the wrong time to be zero funding your parks.
Even though naming rights for parks is apparently not in the picture for this year, Pershey says they may be coming.
Those 3 or 4 generations that gotten all our state parks to where they're at, and now you're just going to turn around and, you know, sell it to the highest bidder so their name can be on what other people have done. There's no soul in that.
Pershey worries that higher camping and park admission fees may discourage some people from using the state parks. The North Beach at Devil's Lake draws many a swimmer, boater, and sunbather. Kyle Kramer of Des Plaines, Illinois, says she and her family often come to the park, but she says that could change if the state of Wisconsin keeps pushing up user fees.
Well, I hate to see the fees go up because it's such a family-friendly place and you don't want to spend, you know, we just come here with our kids all the time, and I think if it was real expensive, we'd probably stop coming.
Kramer says Illinois has come up with a variety of new park fees, and she doesn't want Wisconsin getting the same ideas. Some Wisconsinites, like Madison resident Chris Lenzendorf, have a cultural concern. He says the state parks, as they are now, have a certain feel.
It's a Wisconsin feel. It's who we are. It takes us back to our youth. Nothing's changed, and the parks haven't changed, and they shouldn't change, because this is who we are. This is Wisconsin.
But unless the state Senate, Assembly, or Governor Walker change gears this month, it appears the state parks are going off general tax dollars. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.